This episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by Ford Motor Company. Built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress, from connectivity to autonomy, AI to machine learning, Ford has one simple goal: to improve mobility for its customers. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com. The Inside Transportation Podcast is also sponsored by Fenwick & West. Fenwick & West is one of the world's first and leading law firms dedicated to technology and transportation. Learn more about how Fenwick can help companies tackle the complex legal and business issues of autonomous transportation at fenwick.com. That's F-E-N-W-I-C-K.com. Hello and welcome to the Inside Transportation Podcast, a production of Inside.com. This is our weekly podcast where we discuss transportation trends that you need to know about to stay ahead of the curve. My name is Johan Marino, and I'm the writer of the Inside Transportation and Inside Electric Vehicles newsletters. And what a wild week in the world of electric vehicles. Tesla had their big battery day event this week, as I'm sure we're all familiar and have been anticipating. And some people are very disappointed about it. It's so crazy. Many Tesla fans expressed disappointment with the announcements made during Battery Day. Some fans were expecting immediate price drops on Tesla vehicles. Others expected new products or a potential refresh of the Model S and X. Tesla did reveal the new Plaid Model S, which is going to be really, really, really awesome. It can go 0 to 60 in less than 2 seconds and complete a quarter mile in less than 9 seconds. And I'm sure nobody's mad about that. But it's due in late 2021, and it starts at over $139,000. So crazy. The specs are actually faster than previously expected. Tesla also said that they were going to come out with a $25,000 electric vehicle in about 3 years. They also revealed some awesome details on what they're doing with their battery cells. So Tesla officially told us they're getting into the battery cell production business, as well as developing this revolutionary tabless battery design, battery cell design, which should make the, you know, EVs faster, you know, have more power, be able to go longer on a single charge, and all of this stuff, right? But the market didn't respond well to it because it's not an immediate thing. Elon said, you know, this stuff isn't going to go into full-scale production until 2022. So I just want to say this real quick. The thing about Tesla is that I feel like a lot of investors ride the highs and the lows based on what's happening currently in the marketplace. But if you think about a lot of these rumors, the reason why people weren't surprised about them was because we had been kind of speculating about this for quite some time. Million Mile Battery and a lot of these other evolutions or revolutions that are happening in the EV space through Tesla, they're already accounted for when people buy the stock, right? If we're just talking about stock price, I think when it comes in terms of what Tesla's doing in the marketplace, I mean, they're still ahead of every other EV maker, every other automaker in terms of what they're doing as far as their technology goes. You know, maybe it wasn't exactly a million mile battery announcement. I think me and a few of, you know, my friends who cover Tesla and EVs were widely expecting that. And we were crossing our fingers that we would see that kind of technology out in the marketplace. But, you know, we didn't get it. At least not now. It's being worked on. Cobalt free battery. That was a rumor, you know, we had heard that is in the works. like I said, not immediately. We're not immediately going to see this in the marketplace, but cobalt-free battery is something they're working on. They're working on battery recycling, which I think is going to be awesome. And we actually had someone from Li-Cycle, which is another company that is doing battery recycling, on our show a few weeks ago. So that's going to be really interesting. They're mining for their own materials. That's something we've been reading as well. The Maxwell acquisition is the reason why Tesla is now able to build their own battery cells. That's something we have actually seen in the past as well. So a lot of these revelations from the Battery Day event might be no surprise to people who follow closely to what's happening internally at the company. And I feel like if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have an idea or you have heard of some of these rumors, right? But that's what they were, right? There were rumors, there were speculations, there were internal like reports, all of this stuff, right? And now a lot of those reports have basically been validated and we're all like, oh, okay, what else? What else? To be completely honest, I think we're so used to the development cycle of personal electronics. And when I talk about that, I mean like Apple, Panasonic. Sorry, not Panasonic. I meant to say Samsung. But okay, think about Apple, right? They come out with a new iPhone pretty much every year. And we've come to expect that. And we kind of ride the highs and lows of the current iPhone, right? Tesla and other EV makers have to operate differently because you can only make so many announcements like when it comes to automotive, right? And we are all used to automakers kind of following this model of like, okay, we're going to have the 2020 version of this car, and then we're going to have the 2021 version of this car. And it's literally the same car with just a few minor differences. But, you know, the automaker can say, okay, this is the new version of this car. Tesla's operating completely different, as are many other EV companies. And I think that's what we're, you know, we should expect as speculators of the EV industry is, number one, you know, as we saw with Nikola, which is another topic we'll have to jump into detail on this podcast. But when you look at Nikola, right? And when you look at all these other EV companies that have said a lot and have not produced anything, you have to look at everything with a grain of salt when it comes to electric vehicles. What I think is interesting about Tesla is that after kind of making all of these bold announcements a few years ago, they've kind of adjusted their announcement cycle, right? They haven't been telling us, okay, we're going to do this moonshot idea and put it out into the marketplace in 3 years and then maybe not deliver on it, right? And what I mean by that is self-driving. I mean, I don't think we're going to see full self-driving by the end of the year. That's just my personal thoughts. Obviously, many people that I speak to that drive Teslas basically say that the software is pretty much there. We'll see about that. I think, you know, it's definitely not level 5. Definitely not something you would want to sleep in. Anyway, I promise there is an actual podcast after my ramble, and we have two special guests on the show today. So first off, we have Matthew Johnson Robertson, who is the founder of Refraction AI. Refraction is developing a very awesome mini autonomous vehicle that can make deliveries. So we're going to be speaking with him. And then also be speaking to Abulzar K, who is the sales and marketing director for Xshore, an electric boat company based out of Sweden. They're doing, I said Sweden. I meant Sweden. Doing some very impressive work in the space. They've been called the Tesla of boats by many tech and media publications. So without a further ado, Matthew will join us on this podcast. And look, I think next week what we're going to do is we're going to do a good old-fashioned news roundtable with Jason. I think he did something on This Week in Startups where he discussed Nikola. So we'll probably get some of his thoughts there because he talked to the man himself, Trevor Milton, who is mysteriously off of Twitter now. He deleted his Twitter account. This guy was literally on social media all day. And now he's without Twitter. So we'll see where that goes. Next week, We're going to be doing News Roundtable with Jason. We'll be talking about Tesla, Nikola, all that good stuff. I want to catch up with my good friend, Jason Calcanis, who also happens to be my boss. And yeah, if you have any suggestions for guests that we should interview on this podcast, send me an email, johan@insight.com. Thank you for listening. And without further ado, here's Matthew Johnson Robertson, the founder of Refraction AI, here on Inside Transportation. Stay tuned.
Hey, everybody. Just want to let you know that this episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by our friends at the Ford Motor Company, built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress from connectivity to autonomy. Ford has one simple goal, and that's to improve the mobility of its customers. Ford has been using technology to shape the future of transportation for over 100 years and is dedicated to solving the world's most pressing mobility issues. What you might not know is that Ford has a series of divisions that make these visions a reality. Ford X is Ford's venture incubator that unites entrepreneurs, designers, and engineers to shape the future of transportation. Ford's City Innovations team brings innovative ideas to life through community workshops, crowdsourcing initiatives, and citywide mobility challenges. And Spin, a property of Ford, brings e-scooter sharing to cities and college campuses. So here's your call to action. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com.
Hello, thank you for listening to the Inside Transportation Podcast, a production of Inside.com. This is our weekly podcast where we discuss transportation trends that you need to know about to stay ahead of the curve. My name is Johan Marino, and I'm the writer of the Inside Transportation and Inside Electric Vehicles newsletters. And today we have a very special guest. So last year, a secretive startup came out of Michigan to make its debut at a TechCrunch event, showing off an autonomous delivery vehicle that can be used for last-mile delivery and can safely operate in all weather conditions. The Rev 1 robot from Refraction AI hit the streets of Ann Arbor, Michigan in December 2019 and has already stirred a buzz in the industry. To learn more about Refraction, we are joined here today by Matthew Johnson Robertson, a co-founder of Refraction AI, as well as an associate professor of robotics at the University of Michigan. Fun fact about Matthew, he's actually been working in robotics since the first DARPA Grand Challenge in 2004, where we've seen a lot of prominent autonomous vehicle developers spring out of that event. So welcome to the show, Matthew. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I appreciate it. So how have you been dealing with this whole COVID-19 pandemic? You know, any effects to your business or personally? Like, how do you feel kind of going through this moment in time?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenging time. And I don't want to underplay, how difficult it's been for so many people. For us, I think it's been interesting. It's been in some ways really difficult because we build a physical product and it's
right.
Still really experimental. And so we have a lot of people that need to actually deal with the manufacturing and assembly and those kind of things. So that's difficult. But the flip side of that has really been that it's been a huge opportunity for people to see the value and perhaps to understand how contactless delivery could become a really important part of, you know, what the future looks like. So it's been a mixed blessing in that way. I think if I could have my pick, I would still vote for no global pandemic, but right. We're trying to do the best we can under those constraints.
Did see you guys started like a grocery delivery test with one of your vehicles during the pandemic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's really been one of the biggest changes for us is that when we got into this, you know, prior to the pandemic, we were thinking mostly about prepared food because that was sort of the largest and most established market.
Right.
But really what became really apparent, and it was sort of anecdotal, but my parents had called me and they told me how difficult a time they were having getting Instacart deliveries. If you remember early in the pandemic, there was a strike and Instacart was having a really hard time keeping up with demand.
Yeah. That was
and
crazy.
So it made sense to us to start to think about grocery. And it's, one of these markets that we think is going to be, well, we've seen huge growth in already. And so we think it's an excellent opportunity to expand the utility of the vehicle.
Yeah. So how about we take a step back and tell us a little bit more about Refraction AI? What is it that you're putting out there in the marketplace?
Yeah, so as you kind of highlighted, about a year ago, maybe a little bit longer, we got together, me and Ram, my co-founder, and we said, look, let's try to build a new autonomous vehicle that does something different, which is that that attempts to address this challenge of something that is larger than some of the sidewalk delivery robots that had been built before, but smaller than some of the full-size autonomous vehicles that you'd be familiar with at Waymo or Cruise or even vehicles like at Nuro. And so we said, look, you know, I think there's this really interesting space in this liminal zone between those other sizes, but also in this liminal zone of the road that is between sort of full-size vehicles and then, between the sidewalk and between the streets. So that's the bike lanes, that's the margin of the road, next to the curb, really that zone. And so we started building a vehicle that comes tries to deal with that form factor. So it's about 100 pounds, travels 10 to 15 miles an hour. And so really is what I like to call this Goldilocks zone in between larger and smaller vehicles. And again, I don't think it solves every problem out there in the last mile logistics space, but we think it can solve some that have remained really tricky for a lot of different companies.
Right. So when you're talking about food delivery, grocery delivery, what are some other applications or uses for this vehicle that you envision in terms of last mile delivery?
So I think there's a lot of space and perhaps opportunity in things like medicine and other forms of sort of delivery that we know are critical. So if you think about medical campuses, or even if you think about different corporate campuses, oftentimes lots of things have to move around and you don't need to go at 50 miles an hour, but you probably can't go at 2 or 3 miles an hour either to make it faster or more cost effective than human beings. So one of the areas that I think we're most excited about is thinking about how we can do things to help particularly vulnerable groups during this period. So that's the elderly or the immunocompromised or people just otherly generally that need things brought to them. And I think medicine could be a huge, huge avenue for us in terms of things that we haven't thought about yet.
What I think is super interesting about your startup is that it's based in Michigan, which is kind of the hub for transportation and automotive historically. What are some advantages you see out of being based out of Michigan versus being in Silicon Valley?
Well, you know, to start, it was our backyard because I was already living here. So probably that was the but on a more serious note, one of the things that started to emerge is Southeast Michigan particularly has become a huge hub for people that are looking at transportation startups and thinking about ways of doing things in the transportation space because of the long and rich history of Detroit and all of the automotive work that's already going on here. So for us, one of the huge advantages of that was there's a huge automotive supply chain, but also assembly, manufacturing, and a lot of the things that if you're building physical product like we are, that are in some ways actually richer than what's available in the Bay when it comes to building things. And so I've been continually impressed by what we've had access to here when it comes to building something that is a lot like a car.
Right.
And so it's a good place for that.
And you have M-City, right, which is an initiative at the University of Michigan with autonomous vehicles and transportation, which I'm sure helps, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, why Ram and I were here is no coincidence. We were here because the University of Michigan is a world-class place to do autonomous vehicle research. And so M-City has been an amazing resource for us. And not just that, but also companies and other academics and just people thinking about the future of transportation have been drawn to sort of the larger community that we have here, or ecosystem, because so many people here are working on transportation or thinking about transportation. And so that's been great.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about your background. Why did you decide to kind of step into this startup, you know, start this company? Give us some more background about yourself and kind of your origins of Refraction.
Refraction. So as you highlighted, I've been working in autonomous vehicles for quite a while now. And really the genesis of this company was, you know, Ram and I got together and we said, you know, we've been working in this area for so many years. And in some ways, I think we were fairly frustrated that I still can't walk out of my house and jump in a robo-taxi and go to work. And so what would it mean?
Because that was the promise, right? 2020.
That was the promise.
We're going to see robo-taxis.
That was the promise. And really the, you know, and again, I don't want to disparage any of the really great work that's going on in the robo-taxi field. We're making huge strides still. But I think we said, you know, what if we were trying to think about the limitations of why we don't have robotaxis ubiquitously yet? And a lot of those are around safety. Others are about whether the challenges of having, you know, maps that are of high enough fidelity to be able to drive at the speeds that cars need to drive. But really, I think the biggest challenge is that, you know, we can't pull safety drivers because of the cost and expense and risk that full-size vehicles pose. And so we said, look, if we build something small, we build something light, we think there's a huge opportunity to get on the road quicker, but more importantly, try to get to some vehicle that has a chance of getting to scale. So I would love to build a system that we believe could be all over the United States or all over the world, not on some 10 or 15 year timeline, but in the order of, you know, years and hopefully even months. And so really that was the genesis of why we started Refraction, was we thought there was this gap in the market, particularly around a vehicle that was bigger than sidewalk robots, but smaller than full size robotaxis.
Right. When did you start work on this project? And just a question as far as the tech side, is there LiDAR units installed in the vehicle? What kind of technology do you use for some of the, you know, some of the sensors, or, you know, just to get an idea of what this vehicle actually has as far as capabilities?
Yeah. So, you know, maybe about 18, 19 months ago now, it was sort of an idea that Ram and I were kicking around, and we started actually building the first prototype in my garage. And it was super fun and exciting. And I think for me, it was part of really feeling that passion again, or that excitement that I had felt, you know, a long time ago, when you're like, you're doing something new. And I think part of the great thing about where robotaxis have gone is that's become a fairly mature field in many ways. And so why I was excited about this is just, it felt like we were trying to blaze some new ground or break some new ground here. And so I was really excited about that. And from the technology perspective, again, why I was excited is that we wanted to do something different. You know, what I didn't want to do is just build a scaled down robotaxi. And so from a sensor perspective, I think the biggest thing that we saw is we wanted to break this dependency on a really, really high resolution and right now particularly expensive HD LiDAR is the basis of most of the production systems around robotaxis. And so we do have a forward-looking LiDAR, but, you know, the biggest technical difference is we're not using that in the way that a robotaxi would. We're using that as an obstacle avoidance sensor more than anything else. And in fact, our primary navigation sensor is cameras. So there's 12 cameras around the vehicle. We use ultrasound and millimeter wave radar. And in fact, this is not a new idea in the field. You know, if you listen to what Tesla has been kind of promoting for the last 3 years, they've been pushing this idea that cameras and radar could really solve the problem. Now, I think there are a lot of challenges with high-speed highway driving and urban driving with just cameras and radars, and we're trying to address all of those. So I'm not sure anything's a silver bullet, but I do know that the big wins that we've seen are we're not dependent on this really expensive sensor, which lets us bring the price point on the vehicles down. And so we're targeting sub $5,000 in terms of bill of materials.
Wow. Which, per every unit?
Exactly. Which really changes the dynamics around how expensive deliveries need to be, how many deliveries you need to do to be able to pay back for a vehicle. And to give a sense of scale, you know, the high-end Velodyne unit, you know, the 128, is sort of north of $70,000 or $80,000, depending on volume. And that means that, you know, you need to deliver a lot of burritos to offset that. And so we thought that was one of the big challenges and cool, exciting things about the tech.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting because what we have seen in the marketplace so far is automakers like Tesla basically say, hey, we don't even need LiDAR units. While we've seen like Lucid, which is another EV maker that just came out on the marketplace, they actually integrated LiDAR sensors in their vehicles. So it's going to be really interesting to see what the future is, whether automakers really adapt LiDAR as that standard and whether they can get the cost down, because it is really expensive, right?
Yeah.
And we keep hearing, you know, oh, we're going to get this down below, you know,
$10,000.
Yeah. And then it's, you know, $5,000 and then $100. And it's like, how are you going to bridge that gap between $70,000 and $100, right?
Exactly, right.
It's tough.
So look, I believe it's going to happen. Like, you know, most of the costs, you know, the underlying components are actually not so expensive or fundamentally so difficult to build that there's not a way that it can get lower. Really what you're seeing is that we need wide enough adoption for real tangible business cases that mean that the volume manufacturing and production that goes into automotive can be brought to bear on LiDAR. And we're starting to see that, right? So you see some adaptive cruise control systems in production cars now switching over to LiDAR as that means. Now, not the Velodyne 128, not that kind of really high resolution model. But I think it's a matter of time, really, until these solid state systems, which ultimately are where those big cost reductions are going to come, filter in. And so, you know, I'm a firm believer that you should use any sensor that is that you can get your hands on that does the job. And you really want to have a kind of a multimodal approach. And so I'm much not like Tesla's. I am not in no means am I averse to LiDAR. It's a great sensor. It offers many things. But I am averse to spending $70,000 on a vehicle sensor.
Right.
Today,
and they did say that some of the technological capabilities of combining, you know, cameras with radar are almost the same as LiDAR. I think there was some research that came out on that about a year ago or like 2 years ago that kind of validated Tesla's you know, stance on it.
You
right?
can do a lot with those two sensors.
And it just comes down to the what you have, right? The data sets you have and the programming behind it, which I think ultimately make the difference.
No, exactly.
As far as the business model here, are you envisioning selling these directly to delivery companies like a DoorDash, like a Postmates, or do you envision like a licensing kind of deal? What do you see as far as the business model here?
Yeah, look, so we're, you know, it's early days, and so we're kind of exploring a bunch of these. But, you know, the biggest driver of this, at least in the short term, is that as opposed to selling the vehicles, we're running it as a service now. And really what that comes down to is asset utilization, right? If you think about the end of the day, we have this asset, which we have to build and invest in, which is the vehicle. And the more we can amortize the cost of that across, you know, A, usage, which is like if you can get it running 24 hours a day, great, right? More deliveries, more income, more amortization of that cost. But then secondly, you know, one of the challenges I think that you would face in terms of using such a vehicle just for one thing, like let's say DoorDash, is that if you look at DoorDash's demand profile, it's really, really concentrated at a couple of times, right? People order lunch and people order dinner, and mostly dinner. Mm. And the idea is that, you know, the gig economy model works really well for that because you don't need a DoorDash driver on when there's no deliveries happening. But with an asset that you have to own and depreciate like a vehicle, the idea that it's going to sit mostly dormant for three quarters of the day really doesn't work out numerically.
Yes, you're right.
And so at least for the moment, until there's a better plan, we're looking at a bunch of different models that would allow us to use the vehicle across a variety of applications, just so that, again, you can amortize the cost of that vehicle maximally.
Do you still have these vehicles operating in Ann Arbor, and is there any potential expansion plan to the near future?
Yeah, so, you know, we had really exciting expansion plans that sort of got put on hold by COVID, tragically.
Oh, man.
But what we decided to do is to double down in Ann Arbor. And so for the moment, what we've done is we've expanded the fleet. We'll be at 25 vehicles by the end of this month. And part of that is really about us trying to understand what it means to saturate a city with vehicles. And so our hope was to start to expand into Detroit and then maybe Chicago and probably also the West Coast as well. But the big challenge, and this is sort of one of the things that you asked about before, is that, you know, with COVID, one of the biggest concerns we have is for our own employees, right? And so having them hop on a plane and commute back and forth from, let's say, the West Coast, it feels really scary still. And so I think our expansion plans are going to be places we can drive until we're in a better place, at least in the U.S. with regard to the virus.
Right. And what's been some of that initial consumer feedback on the vehicle? Have you made any changes to it based on user experience so far?
Yeah, a couple of things. So one of the first things, it's kind of an interesting anecdote, is that we have a big football team here, and this is all pre-virus. And so Michigan was playing Michigan State, which is one of our big rivals. And so there was a huge party and they wanted pizzas, and it was a sorority that was hosting some charity event. And so we filled it up. They wanted 120 pizzas. Again, it seemed crazy to me, but I guess, they eat a lot of pizza. And so one of the first things we realized is that the doors were too small to fit a full-size New York-style pizza. And so the first prototype, we had to expand the doors. A lot of the ergonomics of how people access the vehicle, we started to think about. So really in response to consumer feedback, we changed how the doors open, where they are, how you open the vehicle itself, where the keypad is, all those kind of things. And then COVID has obviously also had a bunch of implications. So we've installed UV lights in the vehicles. We've thought about how to clean the vehicles between every run, and then also how do the people open the vehicles without having to touch them. So, you know, it's a constant feedback process. But for us, ultimately, yeah, it's trying to figure out how do we provide a great delivery experience. And also, how do we educate consumers on what robot delivery is like? Because I think one of the big challenges for us is that very few people, if any, have gotten delivery from a robot before. And so that experience is, in some ways, really different than having a DoorDash driver. But in the same way that people adjusted to, you know, DoorDash and Instacart and these other things, we think there's a great ramp to get people acclimated with robot delivery.
Yeah, and I think robot delivery is ultimately going to be the gateway drug to autonomous vehicles, because what we're going to be seeing in the next few years is companies like yours come out with these products, and, you know, people who might be a little bit more apprehensive about the benefits of autonomous vehicles, they're going to see these vehicles roaming around, see that, you know, it's going to make life a lot easier, make life a lot faster. You don't have to deploy like a delivery driver every time you want to order something on DoorDash, or if you're getting your prescriptions, they just come to you in like a little vehicle. And it's going to be awesome because, you know, from that point, people are going to be like, oh, well, you know, I see these vehicles do deliveries all the time. It works. It's flawless. And, you know, I would be willing to take a ride in a robo-taxi when they do finally become available in 2030, 2040 whenever it is, we finally see a level 4, level 5 vehicle.
Exactly.
I don't know if you have any predictions
Well, yeah. Look, I think the folly of a lot of people that made bets or said it's going to be next year. So I have been very cautious in what we predict in terms of full size robo taxis. No, but to your point, I agree wholeheartedly. I think that the idea. And one of the reasons that we thought that this is an interesting entry point is that, you know, one of the fundamental challenges with robotaxis is that human experience of riding in a robotaxi is actually very hard to replicate what it is to ride in a human-driven car for a bunch of reasons. Mm-hmm. There are things like ride comfort, which we're getting better at. But also there are things like, a great example of this is that robotaxis have a really hard time at the first and the beginning and end of a journey, right? So that's when, you know, you're picking somebody up or you're dropping them off. And in fact, one of the things that I think is going to be hardest is that robotaxis are going to be pretty constrained in where they can pick up and drop off. And that experience versus what it is to be dropped off right in front of wherever you want to go is one that is dramatically different. But I mean, one of the cool things about this experience, or at least what it is to get robo delivery, is that the first thing is, because we're a smaller vehicle, we're less constrained on that pickup and drop off component of it. But the second bit is that when no one's riding in the vehicle, so all the safety concerns and fears you would have about being in something that's driving you around go away. But then also, one of the big problems that robotaxis face is sort of this operational domain constraint. And, you know, they can't go on certain roads, they can't go in certain areas, they can't do X, Y, or Z. And a lot of that goes away when you're not in a vehicle. And so I can take a really circuitous route from a delivery perspective, and you don't see that as the end consumer. You just see the vehicle pull up, and you don't know that we actually avoided the four-way stops, the unprotected left-hand turns, the roundabouts, all of the worst, hardest things for AVs. We don't have to do any of those, and you don't have to be annoyed when we go 6 blocks out of the way because you know that that's not the fastest route to your house.
Right. Do you guys go directly to door on deliveries, or do you just kind of go up on the sidewalk? How does that experience work for the customer?
We try to get as close as we can, but yeah, I mean, obviously we can't go up steps. And so we do a lot of pulling into people's driveways in suburban areas, sneaking in between parked cars in denser urban areas, or yeah, pulling up on the sidewalk and just waiting in areas where, you know, we can kind of tuck ourselves out of the way. So again, smaller, lighter vehicle, we have more flexibility in terms of where we go. But I do think that that's one of the big kind of things to learn over the next, you know, and months for us is, you know, how do we improve that experience? How do we make it the best for the end user?
Awesome. Well, anything our listeners can expect from your company in the near future? Any cool developments you have in the works or anything you want to share?
I think we're just really excited to expand here in Ann Arbor. And then I'm hopeful that in the next, 6 months, we'll be in a place where we can be in three cities by the end of next year. And so hopefully we'll be able to be in a city near some of your listeners sometime soon. And so that's my biggest hope for the sort of next 12 months is that we get to a point where we can safely expand to some other cities and hopefully, bring more customers in on the process and learn some things in at the same time.
Yeah, very interesting that people in Detroit are ordering New York-style pizza. I would think they would want some Detroit-style steel pan pizza.
You know, it's a controversial topic. We have some diehard New York-style pizza devotees. Look, I grew up in New York City. I have become very partial to the Detroit style of pizza. It has really grown on me, and it's very unique. It's not Chicago. It's not New York. It's its own thing. And it's, I think, delicious. Yeah. So you gotta
love those crispy edges where exactly. The cheese just kind of caramelizes on the crust. Oh,
it's unique.
Don't get me started. It's around lunchtime, as you guys can tell, on the West Coast. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Matt Johnson Robertson, co-founder of Refraction AI. Is there a website or anywhere where people can learn more about your company?
Refraction.ai, and then we have a Twitter and Instagram you can follow as well.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks for joining me. And we'll be back right here on the Inside Transportation Podcast. Stay tuned.
Hey, everybody, let me take a moment to thank Fenwick & West. They're one of the world's first and leading law firms dedicated to technology and life sciences. They operate in the fast lane of innovation where ideas often outpace changes in the law. That's where you find Fenwick's autonomous transportation and shared mobility practice, steering startups, technology giants, and major automotive companies through rapidly evolving legal, business, and regulatory challenges, which we talk about here on Inside Transportation all the time. A Silicon Valley original, Fenwick is a national law firm with offices in Mountain View, San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Santa Monica, and even Shanghai. So here's your call to action. Learn more about how Fenwick can help companies tackle the complex legal and business issues of autonomous transportation at fenwick.com. That's FENWICK.com. Thanks again to Fenwick for providing great legal services to me. I use them personally for our investments and for supporting independent media like Inside Transportation. Let's get back to this amazing episode.
Today on the podcast, we'll be speaking to Abizar K, the sales and marketing director for Xshore, an electric boat company based in Sweden, doing some very impressive work in the space. They have been called the Tesla of boat by many tech and media publications. As many of you guys know right now, the boat business is booming as people look for new recreational activities to do socially distant. Boat sellers, at least in the U.S., have reported sales spikes of 50 to 100%, many of these buyers being new buyers. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about the space and some of the companies doing very interesting work in the boating space. So Xshore has been called the Tesla boat by many tech and media publications. Thank you so much for joining us today, Abizar. How is beautiful Sweden today?
John, thank you so much for having me on the air today.
Great.
Sweden has never been so shiny. We're almost in September and everyone is still in t-shirts, still on their boats, enjoying the last bits of summer before autumn and winter strikes.
Yes. So first of all, tell me a little bit more about yourself and how you got involved with Xshore.
Sure. I have a multicultural background, right? So I'm a mix between Iran and France, and I have been blessed by parents who taught me to embrace both these cultures. It should be from a literature, music, art, poetry, language point of view. And it kind of always reflected, into me. And after my graduation, this is where I immediately started to work on an international level. I was in Paris and London and Hungary and eventually moved out to Dubai, where I was traveling all the time between the Middle East, Africa, and Southeast Asia.
Wow.
And, eventually I had a eureka moment. And this is where my story with Xshore actually started. Xshore is a marine tech company that makes fully electric silent craft to save our oceans and, of course, deliver a world-class user experience. So when I had my Eureka moment, I kind of built a 50 pages business case, sent it to Conrad, our founder, and told him, Conrad, I'm your guy. And ever since we started to work together to build this amazing company that X-Ray is.
Wow, that's impressive. So you just sent him this business plan out of the blue. Was it? Did you see a job listing at all on their website, or were you just passionate about this company and you were like, hey, I want to be a part of it?
No, so 2 years ago, X-Ray was just a prototype. There was no job out there. And, you know, I had looked at the electric mobility startup environment. And of course, a lot of things were happening on land mobility. Should it be electric trucks, electric cars, autonomous shuttles? But I came to realize that nothing was happening in the marine world, right? And the marine world accounts for what's one of the biggest polluters in the world. So I started to look for electric boats, and as surprising as it might sound, 2 years ago there was like almost nothing out there, at least in Europe.
Right.
So when I saw that, I was like, I have to do this, and this is my thing. And I looked up, I found Conrad, and I was like, I just need to be bold, you know. So if you want to succeed in an industry like such as the marine industry and kind of challenge a very traditional industry that doesn't want to change their habits, you need to be bold. And Conrad was bold, so I was like, I'm going to be bold too. And here I am now.
Wow, that's really impressive. So I've often read that many consider X-Shore to be the Tesla of boats. What are some of your thoughts on that characterization? Do you see any parallels between the companies besides the fact that you guys offer an electrified offering? Give me some thoughts there.
So Tesla is definitely an amazing, impressive company that paved the way for everything that is happening today in the mobility landscape. Mm-hmm. It is super flattering for us to be compared to Tesla. And that is particularly done by the media. They love to call us the Tesla of the sea because you understand immediately what we're doing, high performance electric boats. I would say that from a business model perspective, it's right. We're kind of going the same way Tesla is going. So what we want to do is allow market price reductions with economies of scale, which means that we can eventually become what we call the people's boat. We really believe that anyone should be able to access an electric boat regardless of their wallet.
Wow, that's very impressive. Obviously, right now, you guys, the product you guys have or the models you have are very high end. I think I read somewhere, you know, in dollars, they're about $200,000, right, for an X-Shore boat. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about the different models you have and some characteristics of those boats?
Yeah. So the model today we have, the Elex 8000, is around $300,000. Mm-hmm. So if we go back a little bit, so 2 years ago, we launched our first prototype back then called the Smergen 8000. And ever since, we designed an additional three prototypes, so including the Elex 6500, the Elord 6000, and previous iterations of the Elex 8000. So we produced in smaller numbers, and they have essentially been used for demos, trials, and get the word out there that electric boating is also happening. And essentially, we spent these past 2 years working out what makes the perfect boat for our customers from a user interface perspective, from a user experience perspective. And there was a clear majority of people that actually showed an interest for the Elex 8000. That's why we led, we put all our efforts into this boat, and in September we'll be launching the Elex 8000, the edition 2021, which will be our first commercialized range of boats to be delivered to selected customers in 2020.
Wow. So as far as what the eventual goal is for Exshore, right? Because you were saying we want to be the people's boat. What price range can people expect for the eventual expansion into like the mass market boat market? And as far as what Exshore is going to do or how they're going to price the boat, how does that compare to what traditional boats are priced?
So that is a very good question. There are several things. So first of all, we're going to diversify our portfolio of boats. So right now we have an open boat, a day cruiser.
But it's a very nice boat, by the way. We'll put a link in the show notes to make sure people can see this boat. It's amazing.
It is. I mean, and being on board is even more amazing. Imagine being on a boat without any noise or fumes, like sailing without the wind, basically.
Yeah, because the only sound you hear is just the water displacement, right?
Exactly. The water against the hull. And that is just amazing. You were talking earlier about, you know, having a drink with a few friends on a boat and so on. This is exactly what we can offer as an experience. It's not only high performance, but it's also a social boat where people can, thanks to the modular system that we have on board, which is one of our inventions, kind of or set up the boat the way they want for their journey. If you want to go out with friends to have a drink, then you can have a table and chairs. But if it's your diving day, please feel free to equip the boat with the diving equipment and have fun under the water. So that's very much the mentality that we work with, where we really want to offer something different to a traditional industry while respecting craftsmanship. Mm-hmm.
So as far as that pricing goes, though, for the people's vote, do you have any idea there yet? Is it still a conversation? Are you still trying to finalize that?
That is a really good question. So our goal as a company is to produce on an industrial level in the coming years. So we're going to start with small numbers, but we're planning on scaling up. Scaling up will mean economy of scales, which means that the price of the boat will come down. We cannot give any number. I cannot give any number right now today. But we're definitely aiming at providing something that will be under $150,000 as soon as possible.
Wow, great. So obviously, as you know, a lot of electric vehicle makers face challenges, range anxiety, adequate charging infrastructure. Do you see these same challenges in the boat space? How do you deal with those challenges?
That's a really good question, actually. One of the things that is super interesting and maybe a little bit paradoxical is that harbors are already equipped with electricity today, but they don't have electric boats. So for instance, if you go out here in Sweden, in the archipelago with your electric boats, which is what we're doing all the time, we always find harbors equipped with a two or three phase charger. The car industry, they have a lot of electric cars, but not enough infrastructure. So what we see is that in the coming years, and with the rise of electric boating becoming more democratized and more accessible and more thought of, companies, governments, cities will put the necessary efforts to set up the right infrastructure. And that can be fast charging infrastructure where you can charge your boat in 40 minutes. And that would be a game changer for the industry.
Wow. that's impressive. So I also see that you guys have a partnership with Polestar, which is a joint venture between Geely and Volvo. Tell us a little bit more about how that originated and what we can expect from this venture in the future.
So in Sweden, we have a very collaborative mind in things we're doing. So Polestar wasn't... I'm not sure if partnership is the right word. I would say like a collaboration of two electric mobility startups. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is to show that, you know, electric cars, electric boats is now a reality. And we actually did a super interesting event a few weeks back where we gathered different actors from different industry in the electric mobility landscape, from electric motorbikes to electric wakeboards, of course the actual boat and the Polestar car, and we went on a diving mission in the archipelago to clean it from all the dirt that was under, and we really saw a huge inflow of people really realizing that, oh my God, it has happened. There has been a shift, and now everything is available from, like, everything is available and electric, which is super interesting because it shows that working together, even though we come from different industries, really pays off. And this is what people want to see in order to be able to tackle all these climate issues and challenges.
Yeah, and I thought it was very impressive because the Polestar isn't a huge car. And usually when I think about a boat and how, you know, boats that can tow or cars that can tow or trucks that can tow a boat, I mean, it's usually like a big pickup truck, a big SUV. But it was like the Polestar 2, right? Is that the vehicle that you were showing off towing that boat? But why don't you tell us a little bit more about the weight of the boat and whether, you know, what kind of capacity do you need to kind of tow this boat around?
So the boat they were towing was the E-Lord, which is our 6-meter boat. And it's still on the prototype phase. It's 1,200 kilos. It's part of the different boats I was talking about earlier. And it was actually very impressive to see Polestar easily towing that boat around. You're absolutely right. You usually see trucks towing this kind of boats, but it just shows that electric cars, electric boats, whatever it is, are as performant as your traditional engine for your car or for your boat.
Yeah, that was really impressive because I was like, wow, this car is so small, yet it's towing such a big boat. And it's going to be exciting how that kind of evolves over the next few years, because I'm sure a lot of EV makers are going to realize, hey, you know, there's this new space where people have boats recreationally because they want to do some fun activities out on the water. And, you know, we got to equip our cars to be able to tow this kind of capacity. But kind of asking a little bit more about that. In some markets, like here in the U.S., boat sales have hit an all-time high. People are looking for local, socially distant activities. I think people don't normally think about boating even in the middle of, let's say, like the United States, but there's a lot of rivers and lakes, and everyone kind of has access to some sort of body of water. Have you seen similar trends globally? And do you think it's here to stay? Do you think we're in a new era of the boat?
That is totally what we see here as well in Sweden. We definitely see a global trend where there are more and more what we call staycations, which also means that there are more demand for boats and therefore more demand for electric boating, which again kind of put a lot of pressure on local cities and governments to install the right infrastructure so people can invest in electric boats. What we saw in the archipelago this summer was impressive. We have never seen so many boats out there, sailing boats, motor boats, and the recreational market is really booming. People either go to their cottage houses or they spend their whole summer, weekend, holidays on their boat isolated. I mean, this whole COVID situation completely changed the way we are enjoying life. And we definitely see this. Back to what you were saying in the US, I mean, the recreational boating market in the US is huge. If you look just at Florida and California, it's $23 billion and $13 billion just for these two states, which is much bigger than many other countries.
Yeah. Are you guys working to expand to the United States? I think that's what a lot of our listeners want to know. I mean, a lot of our listeners are tech investors in Silicon Valley, and I'm sure they would love to take a next short boat around. When can we expect to see one of these boats in the U.S.?
I love it. I love that you're asking this question. So we are aiming at coming to the U.S. in 2021. And it's very simple. If you just look at the economical impact of the recreational boating in America, it is huge. $170 billion of manufacturers, suppliers, sales, services, boating activities. The American market is a very important market for us. There are more than 12 million registered boats there, and more than 140 million Americans boat every year. recreational boats. So we need to come to the US, and we're really looking forward to come there. Our audience on social media, on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, a lot of them are from the US, and we constantly receive requests from, well, California, Florida, even Texas, New York, where people are saying, when are you coming here? We need an electric boat.
Yeah.
So 2021 should be the year.
Well, you better invite me out for a little fun out on the water. So another question for you here.
Yeah.
Obviously, you guys are very the plan is to make it the people's boat, recreational boating, but I'm sure. Have you guys thought about expanding into like commercial industries that also use boats, like fishing and those industries?
That is a very good question. So when we thought when Actual was built, it was built around three pillars: so design, technology, and sustainability. If we look at the sustainability part of boating, it's not only about having an electric motor and batteries, right? It's also about being able to use these boats in different industries for different purposes. Right. And part of the way we build this company, we built it on a modular system. All these boats are built on a modular system with aluminium rails present on the boat. And when we will take you out there for a spin, hopefully next year, we will show you that more in detail. But to answer your question, should it be for fishing? Should it be for diving? Should it be for patrolling, boat chartering? Thanks to this modular system, we can easily adapt the boat to the person's need. So I would say that we're actually ready to commercialize these boats for businesses.
Yeah, so another question for you, based on you talking about expanding to North America and possibly getting into the US market, I'm just curious, when you develop or when you manufacture these boats, is it difficult to kind of transport them around internationally, right? Is the plan to kind of produce boats in Sweden and have them transported out throughout the world? Or does it make more sense to kind of manufacture locally in the markets you're planning to expand to? Any insight there?
That's a really good question. We really need to see how the market will behave. Is electric boating really going to be a big thing in the US or not? And are we going to find the right partners to establish a factory there and produce the boats locally? Obviously, that would help to save a lot of time for the buyers. But we're not there yet. I think 2021 will tell us a lot more about how our future looks like in the US. But as of today, I can tell that it's going to be very positive.
Yeah, because I think it's kind of interesting because there's a electric vehicle company that's based in China called Kandi, and they're starting to sell electric vehicles in the US, importing them from China. And yesterday they said, hey, we're looking at expanding, into a North American production facility because we don't want to pay tariffs. We don't want to pay, the import costs and the shipping costs of moving these cars around. So it's interesting how, companies that have a presence or a big presence in China or Europe and different places are thinking, hey, we should rethink how we're transporting these vehicles because it gets pretty expensive to transport them around. So that's a very interesting insight. But I guess kind of wrapping things up here on the podcast, and thank you so much for your time. And by the way, Alvazar is joining us from Sweden. I'm based in the US, so had to wake up a little early today to just talk with him. But is there anything, any other interesting announcements or anything you want to share with our listeners today on the podcast?
I would say have your eyes open. In the coming weeks, we're going to release the Elex 8000, the 2021 edition, and it's going to be something else. It's going to definitely inherit most of the looks and great features of our previous versions, but it's going to be, from a user interface and user experience perspective, completely game-changing for electric boating.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And where people can learn more about you is xshore.com. Is that the website?
xshore.com, correct.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to sailing with you in the near future. And thank you so much for joining me today. This was a really awesome talk. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, John.